And welcome. I'm Dr. Mona Kular, and this is To Immunity and Beyond. I'm a medically trained doctor and nutrition and health coach, and I love helping people find the very best version of themselves. This show is all about living well, feeling well, and most importantly, aging well. The immune system is essentially the body's wellness system, so by understanding and supporting it, we can all reach an optimal level of health. I'll be having conversations with a wide range of experts from around the world on all the areas that can support our immune system to help us live healthier for longer. Let's live life better. Hello and welcome to Immunity and Beyond. My guest this week is Joanna Kippax, a qualified senior nurse prescriber and certified sleep practitioner. Joanna has 37 years of nursing experience in the NHS and now works with groups and individuals to deliver cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia and help those with sleep issues. She has also set up the Sleep Retreat, a weekend retreat to treat insomnia while staying in a luxury hotel. Hello, Jo. Very nice to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for this invitation. It's very exciting.
We're going to be talking about one of my favourite topics today, so I'm actually really excited about this one. So you are a registered nurse and now you work with clients on their sleep. Can you tell us how you journeyed from nursing into the world of sleep?
Of course. This is my big passion. So yeah, I shall try and keep it brief. So I've been nursing for over 35 years, and over my career, I've done lots and lots of different things, but the last 10 years of my NHS work was spent in the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. And I was seeing young people coming with real sleep problems over and over again. And my specialism was ADHD, so, you know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And, you know, I started to really, really sort of get so interested in why these children weren't sleeping. And actually, some children were sort of slightly misdiagnosed, because a lot of sleep deprivation in children is masked as sort of a mental health problem. And actually, it's just the sleep that needs to be addressed. So I just started to get really, really interested in this. And I decided to leave the NHS at that point and do some sleep practitioner training. So I did some work with Professor Ellis, Jason Ellis, up in Edinburgh, and the Oxford University CBTI course, and down in Southampton as well, Southampton University. So I sort of started to really gather my skills together, and I just got completely and utterly bitten by the bug. I just think it's just so interesting, and it's an area that is so important, but is so overlooked. And we get a lot of sort of hype in the media about a panic of lack of sleep, but there's nobody there to say, look, this is the science behind sleep. This is what sleep needs. And that's my passion, is what does sleep need to make it happen? And if we focus on that, we can sort it out, you know, and 90% of the problems you can just think, oh, right, OK, yeah, I've done this, OK, and adjust your routine in some way and sort it out, and instead of having this absolute petrifying fear. Oh, my goodness, I'm not sleeping. This is awful for my health. Oh, gosh, big panic. So that is my passion. That's what I love. I love learning, absolutely love learning, love reading, love finding stuff out all of the time. So I'm a bit of a boring geeky sort of.
Well, that makes two of us.
And yeah. So interesting.
I agree with you. I think sleep is such a fascinating topic. And I think it's one of my favourite things, actually, to read about in my spare time. Although I feel I talk more about food, but I need to get more sleep information out there. And I wonder if people fall into one of two categories when it comes to sleep, because for people who don't have trouble sleeping, they often don't understand that it can be a real issue for some. If you just go to bed, fall asleep and wake up and that's it, you know, as I suppose it should be, it's a natural physiological process.
Indeed.
I think it can be hard to understand why some people struggle. But if you're in that other camp where sleep is an issue, it's life changing and has a huge impact on absolutely everything that you do during the day. And then, as you say, that sort of fear. Yeah.
Well, this is it becomes a complete obsession, doesn't it? And if you ask a good sleeper, how did they sleep? They'll look at you and think, oh, I just go to sleep. You know, I just what's the issue? You know, whereas if you ask a poor sleeper, how did they sleep? They go, right, well, okay, I do X, Y, Z. I have to have my sleepy tea. I have to get all my ducks in a row. I have to, you know, and it becomes a whole sort of procedure and a process. And once you're in that sort of almost trap, it becomes such a big issue. And that's really where my work sort of tries to cut in and tries to sort of break that cycle. So yeah, it can be absolutely devastating. People lose jobs, they lose relationships, they lose mental health. It's absolutely devastating to not.
And I don't know the answer to this, and I don't know if you do. Do we have any figures in terms of what percentage of, say, the population in the UK struggle with sleep in some way or another?
Yeah. I mean, the British Sleep Society last year during the lockdown actually did some research about just about this actually, and found last year 70% of people that participated in their survey had a change in sleep pattern, and so were either sleeping much better or much worse. In addition to that, they were saying about 45% of people have insomnia. So, you know, that's
always hard.
Is massive, absolutely massive. And, you know, you just think, so we've got 45% of people doing, you know, not sleeping and having this catastrophic sort of effect on their health and their work life. And yet from a service point of view, there seems to be very, very little out there. You know, yes, that there's apps and things like that, but, you know, I work on a much more sort of one-to-one sort of bespoke sort of service, and we need to be addressing those sort of issues. We need to be, you know, because 45% of people, that is an awful lot of people not sleeping.
That's a lot. And as you say, with the knock-on effect on productivity,
absolutely,
mental health, people who are parents, thriving, you know, all those things that can be affected by that.
Absolutely.
I do think the tide is changing, isn't it? I do think that sleep has almost become a slightly cooler thing to talk about now.
To
admit that they need more sleep, which I think has been a big issue for a long time. And that's really good, because it means those conversations can be had more easily, and it's just taking a while to catch up, I think, in terms of getting the relevant and useful information out there.
Absolutely.
The reasons that we've neglected sleep for such a long time. I mean, it's always been championed to sort of just keep going and sleep when you're dead, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And I think there is this sort of culture, and I think it exists, but certainly, as you say, to a lesser extent, that sleep is, it's like the sleep is for wimps type of attitude, isn't it? You know, I only got 4 hours last night and I'm still working. And you just think, if you know all of the advantages of sleep, why would you do that? It just does not make sense, you know, from a productivity, from a performance, from all your relationships, from your creativity. You just think, if you want to do well, do not miss your sleep. You know, that's just madness. So I think certainly that we need to change that culture, and I think it is changing, but there is still that bravado, oh well, you know, I can do without sleep, I'm fine, I'm not tired. And I think, you know, there's a couple of other things there too, is when you get chronically tired, your perception of how much sleep that you actually need is reduced, and you think that you're not tired. Again, that adds to the bravado. You just think, oh well, you know, I'm fine, it's okay, I'm not noticing any change in my performance. People around you might notice, but you might not yourself. Your self-perception is changed.
Definitely.
So that is quite key. So
and I think people perhaps also become very reliant on caffeine and stimulants during the day, which again gives them that sense of actually they're performing well, they're fine. You know, they'll go to sleep for however long, wake up, have more coffee, Red Bull or whatever it happens to
Absolutely.
Be, and then they're going again. And so actually, that as you say, they don't actually have a sense of how much sleep they're getting or where their performance
Indeed.
Is at, because it's all masked.
Absolutely, it is. Absolutely, very much so. Yeah. So it is a sort of a big issue, and it's certainly something that I hope is on the sea change. It would be really, really good if it was.
And what sorts of things do you see in your practice then, because you see clients individually and you do group sessions as well, don't you? Tell us a bit about
I've got quite varied sort of job at the minute, which is really lovely, and which is why I love it so much, really. I see people on a one-to-one basis. Then I do some group works, and then I'm also setting up the sleep retreat, which is a weekend sort of CBTI course condensed into a weekend, plus quite a few other bits and bobs bolted onto that. I've done courses. I did an online course during the pandemic on sort of improving your sleep over a sort of 4-week course, which was quite fun. And then I've done a sort of sleep for mental health course as well for, you know, people with mental health difficulties, because every single mental health diagnosis has got a sleep disturbance attached to it. So, and I think, again, if you can intercept early and really support people with their sleep, then that mental health sort of issue may resolve a little bit more quickly. So, yeah, that's really a sort of my work in a nutshell.
And just for people listening, CBTI is cognitive behavioural therapy for insomnia. So it's a specialised form of CBT therapy.
It is, yes. It's the government's sort of first line sort of treatment, really, for CBTI. And it's got an 80% sort of success rate, so 70-80%. And it's so much better and more sustainable than taking sleeping tablets, you know. So it's a much more holistic way of looking at sleep.
So if we talk about sleep in itself, why do we need, there are going to be people listening to this and people out there who actually think, I don't need that much sleep. As we said, you know, I perform fine, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of this is about educating people about why sleep is so important. So
absolutely.
Can we go over some of the things it does for us?
Of course. So sleep is the foundation of health, and it's pretty much the foundation of life. I mean, you would die quicker of a lack of sleep than you would of a lack of food. We spend 30% of our lives asleep, so we've got a pretty hefty chunk of our life actually staying asleep. And there is very, very good reason why this happens. Every single cell in our body has a little body clock, and each cell needs to work in harmony with each other to perform its functions to its maximum sort of capability. So, you know, you look at pretty much every single system, every single cell, every single part of a body needs sleep at some point. And there is this sort of misperception that nothing is happening when you're asleep. And that's another reason why people sort of tend to sort of forget about it a little bit, because they just think, oh, it's boring, nothing's happening.
And I think even scientists thought that for a very long time, didn't they?
They did. And, you know, I think it's good to remember that sleep medicine is very, very new. I mean, it's only in the last 25 years that sleep medicine has really, really sort of taken the forefront, you know. So it is actually a very new and sort of, burgeoning sort of subject, really. But from a health point of view, so you've got physical health issues like your blood pressure goes down during the night, giving your heart a rest. If you're awake all of the time, or if you're awake at night, you get high blood pressure. The other thing that it does is it lowers your blood sugar. So you are less likely to get diabetes. You are less likely to put on weight. All of your your appetite hormones and your hormones that tell you that you're full are sort of changed in the middle of the night. So you're much more likely to gain weight if you don't sleep, and you can eat the same number of calories, but if you sleep well, you will burn them off quicker. So, you know, for people who are struggling to lose weight, think about their sleep, think how well they're sleeping. It does wonders for our immune system. It does wonders for our learning. You know, it's like a save button. It's like a save file, you know, went for learning. So you have to sleep before learning and then after, and then it will actually sort of save in your memory. Thinking of memory, it helps your memory, and also it helps your forgettery, you know, so it helps you actually forget things. And I think we don't talk about that, do we? You know, you just imagine if you were to remember absolutely every single detail, that your mind will be blown, wouldn't it? You know, it would just be horrendous. I mean, if I asked you what you ate for tea for 3 weeks ago on a Tuesday, you hopefully wouldn't have a clue. You know, and so our brains are so good at losing useless information, you know. And my goodness me, we would pop, wouldn't we, mentally if we didn't have that capacity.
Yeah.
And so actually sleep helps us to forget, and it helps us to process our day, process trauma. I mean, massively important for processing, you know, traumatic events. Yeah, I mean, the list just goes on and on. I could boy to death for ages.
And just touching on a couple of things you've mentioned, starting with the trauma, actually, that ties into that sleeping to forget, doesn't it? Because when we sleep, our brain sort of dissociates some of the emotions or the emotional feelings that we've felt from a memory. So particularly for painful things,
absolutely,
if we were to relive that exact emotional experience every time that memory came up, that would be debilitating,
wouldn't it?
And actually, this is, I think, something that they've looked into with PTSD, haven't they? That
they
PTSD
really
as a syndrome, people who have that struggle with this aspect in their sleep, don't they, that where the brain isn't particularly efficient at removing that emotional connection to a memory, and that's why they have those flashbacks.
Completely. And that's exactly what your REM sleep does. You know, REM is rapid eye movement sleep, and people after a trauma, it's their REM sleep that's disturbed. And so that that's exactly why they can't process and clear out that sort of information. And there's a therapy called EMDR, which replicates REM sleep, and moves that traumatic event from the frontal cortex of the brain to the long-term memory sort of bank, and shifts that sort of a whole sort of section of your memory that seems to cause all these flashbacks and seems to cause all this repeated trauma. So sleep is absolutely crucial in processing information. It really is. It's just, it's fundamental, absolutely fundamental. So, yeah.
And a couple of other things you mentioned. I mean, as you say, the list is endless. It literally is a reset for the entire body every day, isn't it? That puts everything back to where it should be and re sort of regulates everything. With regards to the immune system, obviously the show is about the immune system, and we know for a fact that poor sleep, even just after one night, can downregulate the function of parts of the immune system by up to 70%.
Indeed.
And so, you know, that can make you more likely to pick up infections, take longer to recover from things, and actually even sort of increase that risk of cancer, because our immune system is our cancer surveillance as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It really, really, really is key. And it's what sleep is doing. I mean, because it's a circadian system, so that means it's working over 24 hours. So, you know, we should actually be thinking about sleep in the day. You know, sleep starts from the morning. You know, it's a sort of sleep-wake sort of cycle. It doesn't start when you go to bed. It starts first thing in the morning, as does the immune system. And both of these systems completely interlink in the sense that they have different functions during the day than they do at night. And so if you miss out on a night's sleep, you know, that's where your immune system is going to be compromised, and it's going to react in a different way. And it's also why, I mean, in some ways, it's a sort of a self-protective sort of mechanism that the body has developed to, you know, to make us go to bed, to make us rest. I mean, you know, we've all had days when you just think, oh gosh, I'm going down with something. You know, I don't feel so good. I'm going to go to bed, you know, and that's exactly what we do, isn't it? We have a duvet day, or we sleep. And it is our body's way of just thinking, yeah, you actually really need this. And it helps to fight off that infection. And, you know, what's actually happening from a cell sort of point of view is you're getting all the sort of the T cells, as it were, all the killer cells, the helper cells and the suppressor cells that sort of surround any foreign body that's coming into the body. And they sort of add on to this, add onto the cell a little protein called integrin, and this makes it sort of really sticky, so that it sticks to the foreign body and will remove it much more effectively. Now, if you miss out on sleep, you are making your cells less sticky, so they have less of a chance to actually remove that foreign body, which is why people who are working night shifts or who regularly miss out on sleep can find themselves, you know, more at risk of getting infection. So, it's amazingly complicated, ridiculously complicated. I'm not even going to go there with that. It is something, but it's huge. Yeah.
And night shift working has actually been recognised now, hasn't it, as a risk factor for a number of things, actually. And we've talked a little bit about sort of cancer risk. And the other thing is metabolic syndrome. So that incorporates hypertension, which is high blood pressure, obesity and diabetes.
Yeah.
And that, again, as we've you touched on, you know, sleep helps regulate the hormones involved in your appetite. It helps regulate the hormones involved in your blood sugar control. It lowers your blood pressure. So again, that risk of metabolic syndrome increases with sleep, and that increases your risk of heart disease, which is strokes and heart attacks. So there's this huge knock-on effect.
Massive, massive knock-on effect. And, you know, as you say, I mean, the World Health Organization have actually sort of decided that night shift is going to be sort of classified as a known carcinogen for that very reason. And that's a really hard pill to swallow, isn't it? I mean, certainly I've worked years in night duty over the past. I'm sure you have too.
Absolutely.
You know,
and a lot of our economy and our infrastructure runs on people working through the night. It's a very regular part of life for a lot of people. So I think that's a very difficult come to terms with, really.
It is. But one of the things that I think is really, really key, and I know that you've touched on it previously with your previous speakers, and you know, I've really enjoyed your talk so far. They've been absolutely fantastic. They really have. But it's also really, really good to remember sleep isn't the only thing that keeps us well. You know, we're talking, and this is one of the things that I really love about sort of looking, but in a very holistic sort of way. There's so many other things that we can do to support our health, you know, and whether that's exercise, whether that's nutrition, whatever it is, we need to be looking outside this sort of little sort of box, as it were, and look at health in a much, much wider aspect. And so, you know, you just think, okay, some people have to work night shifts. That's just how they do. How can we support those people to stay well? You know, what can we do with the restrictions that they've got? We've all got certain restrictions anyway. Life is never going to be perfect, and our bodies are so good at sort of being resilient in lots of ways. But how can we support those people to stay well? And you know, do we support them with better nutrition? You know, should all of the I don't know, let's just look at the NHS, for example. Should the hospitals be, you know, opening up their restaurants in the middle of the night and giving their staff really, really fantastically nutritious food, you know? Yeah. And so it's not just one thing. And so I think it's really good not to just focus in and get into a panic and think, oh my goodness, you know, I'm not sleeping. Oh gosh, this is the end of my health. This is awful, you know, because that just increases anxiety. It's, you think, yeah, okay, sleep's not great. That's fine. Let's look at these other ways that you can boost your health. And, you know, that in turn will switch over your sleep, you know? So it's a much more broad sort of holistic brush than thinking, oh, well, I am finished then. That's me done, you know? And I think there is a real danger to fall into that trap.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad you've raised that, actually. As you know, that's what I'm all about, is looking at health from a very multifactorial approach. And sometimes I feel that I'm giving people too much information because I'll talk about stress.
No, carry on.
I find it difficult not to, because they are all interlinked. And as you say, actually, it's impossible for anybody, I think, to be 100% on each of those areas all the time. There are going to be times where your nutrition's completely off track. There's going to be times when you're not moving or exercising very well. But if you can try and balance everything a little bit so that overall you've got a good looking picture, that's what's important, isn't it?
Absolutely. It really, really is. And, you know, again, it is about balance, and it is about sort of, well, you know, you just the fact that you grabbed a McDonald's, for example, last week, That's not the end of the world, is it? You know, you just think, gosh, that, you know, I shouldn't be eating that sort of stuff. I should be eating this. And life is not like that, is it? It's not perfect. But it's just having that overall understanding of what we put in our bodies, how we look after ourselves, and generally over a long period of time, isn't it? You know, just sort of a long term, what is an ideal picture, and we'll try and blend our life around that, you know. So it's like parenting, isn't it? I mean, goodness me, who's a perfect parent all of the time?
So it's
a very similar sort of analogy, isn't it? You know, yeah, you can know all the basics, but sometimes the wheels fall off, you know, and that's okay.
And we, you know, we just carry on and we sort of put them back together as and how absolutely we can, don't we? We're not robotic beings, are we? Human and fallible as well.
Yeah, completely. So yeah.
So people listening, I'm sure the burning question that many of them will have is, how much sleep do we need? And I think there can be a lot of conflicting advice on this, actually, from different camps. So can we go over that? And also, we have different types of sleep through the night, and we need to have a range of those different types. So actually, when we sleep does make a difference too, doesn't it?
Sure, absolutely. So let's go for how much sleep do we need to start with. If I asked you what shoe size you took, you don't have to answer that now on air, but if I asked you what shoe size you took, it could potentially be quite different to mine. And the point of asking that is that everybody is different. We are all of our needs are different. And again, just as every day your activity is different, we seem to expect that, you know, if we have a really, really active day, and we're climbing mountains outside, you know, we're going to have the same amount of sleep as if we sat in front of the sofa all day, you know. And again, this is where the lockdown has completely changed things. So, you know, we talk about sleep need. So your sleep need is going to be different every day. So, and it's going to be different for each person. So I think generally speaking, somewhere between sort of 6 to 8 hours is sort of the ideal amount of time. Then there's the sort of the timing of our sleep, and the timing is our chronotype. So whether you are a night owl, for some people, if they're a night owl, they will go to bed later, and they'll wake up later. For the morning larks, they'll sort of settle at sort of 9 o'clock, and they'll be up at the crack of dawn, and they'll be fine. This is sometimes where insomnia sort of sets in, because people who are night owls, they go to bed thinking, right, that's it. I need to get to bed. I'm going to get an early night. I'm going to just sort of get on top of my sleep. And they won't go to sleep. You can't make a night owl go to sleep earlier. So they will lie there wide awake thinking, oh my goodness, I've got a problem with my sleep. No, you haven't. You just need to go to bed much later. So a lot of my work, I'm telling people the complete opposite to what they think is that I'm going to say. And I say, actually, no, you don't need to go to bed until midnight at the earliest, even later. Let's try you at 1. Let's try you at 2. And they're thinking, this is really, really strange. But, you know, it is your chronotype. So getting your timing of your sleep right and knowing for yourself what is important is actually really, really key to actually understanding how much sleep you need. But the golden sort of answer really is if you wake up in the morning feeling refreshed and energized after a night's sleep, that is your amount of sleep that you need for you. So that is quite a sort of a helpful sort of equation almost. And I think, you know, you say that to people and most people say, oh gosh, I never wake up feeling refreshed. But so you think, okay, let's see where we can make some improvements. But that is the key really, is, you know, if you wake up feeling refreshed, that is enough sleep for you.
Yeah. And that's useful for people to know, because there's no real measure, is there? And so people might think, well, how do I know if I'm getting enough? And I'm really pleased you've said that. So, and I think there's something also to be said for not needing to then wake up and hit the caffeine immediately.
Absolutely.
And actually feeling that you perform fairly well through the morning, yep. because that should be yep. your peak time, shouldn't it?
Absolutely, sort of absolutely.
Sort of 11 midday-ish should be the yep. time when you are most alert and your concentration and yep. focus is good. So that's another way to sort of tell if you've slept enough for you.
Absolutely. I think it also as well, it's worth bearing in mind that our sleep need changes throughout our life. I mean, certainly with babies, the sleep hormone melatonin is very, very high, which is why they sleep for such a prolonged period of time. But as we age, our melatonin production decreases massively. And so by the time you're sort of late 50s, 60s, you know, you're releasing this sort of a trickle really of melatonin. That doesn't mean to say that you don't need sleep. It means to say that your sleep is going to be more fragmented, but that is actually a natural process. That is something that we sort of expect. But it doesn't mean to say that you don't need that sleep. You still need it, but you're less likely to get it. Yeah.
So what are the main issues, would you say, that people face when it comes to insomnia? First of all, there are a few different types of insomnia, aren't there? You can have trouble falling asleep, or you can have trouble waking in the night and getting back to sleep, or you can have trouble waking up too early, where you then can't fall back asleep for the rest of the night. So are there different reasons for those different types of insomnia?
Yes, there are. And I think, you know, sort of rewinding a little bit, it's actually really good to raise awareness in that way, that people may have insomnia that they actually don't realise it, you know, because so many people that you speak to, they say, oh, gosh, I haven't slept for years. I haven't slept properly for years. And you think, well, actually, you could do something about this, you know, and they go, oh, no, I'm just a rubbish sleeper. I just can't sleep, you know, and they just put up with it for so long. So actually identifying that, you know, there are different sort of types of insomnia, as it were, is actually really, really helpful. But I think with this, it is really, really useful to understand the sort of the basic processes that need to be in place for sleep to happen. And there's three things, and it's sort of like in a triangle. There's sleep drive, so that's your need for sleep. Then there's the body clock, which is your timing of your sleep. And then there's a mindset. Now, if your sleep drive, so that means your need for sleep, if you imagine a balloon and you've got a flabby, deflated balloon first thing in the morning, and over the day, you gradually blow into that balloon and increase your sleep need until your balloon is absolutely, completely burst, really, really full. That is the time that you want to go to sleep. That's that moment that you just think, right, bang, I need to go before it completely bursts.
I love that description. I haven't thought of it that way before. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's really, really helpful because if your sleep drive is low. So if you imagine think about the lockdown, how we were reduced activity on the whole. I mean, obviously there's going to be exceptions, but generally speaking, we had reduced our activity. We'd reduced our social contact, which is another driver for your sleep drive. So another thing to put in your balloon. And we had shifted the times that we woke up. Because we, you know, you might be working from home, you might not need to get up for a commute, whatever. You know, that sort of timing of our sleep has changed. Chuck in a bit of anxiety and a bit of mindset, and bingo, there you have your whole, all three processes complete, you know, really, really altered, and enter insomnia, you know. So if you think you can get to sleep, but you can't stay asleep, and that's a really, really common situation. Think about your sleep drive. Think about that balloon. Think about, you know, how much air have you pumped into that balloon? Have you sat on the sofa all day? You know, have you just sort of been working from home and you haven't had the opportunity to have much exercise? So your sleep drive, although you've done a day's work, will still be really low. So that will stop you from staying asleep. So you might get much more fragmented sleep at that point. So it's really building your sleep drive. Blow that balloon up as high as much as you possibly can, and only go to bed when you're sleepy. And that's a sort of a real fundamental. Wake up at the same time every day, only go to bed when you're sleepy, and get out in the morning light. Those three things are the biggest factors for maintaining good sleep. They really are.
Okay.
So hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I love the balloon analogy. So if we go back to that balloon analogy, we're inflating it through the day with the things that we do. So that's getting morning daylight, which is great for pumping some air into the balloon, social interaction, movement, exercise, I suppose even brain stimulation, just you know, anything that taxes you to a degree or challenges you, fresh air. Are there any other things that help to blow that balloon up? I mean, there will be some natural inflation through the day, but it's our job to inflate it more, isn't it, with how we spend our day?
It is, and triggers. The brain is loves a good trigger. It loves, you know, it loves a prompt. And light is the most important trigger, absolutely fundamental. Morning light tells your brain that actually it's daytime. But also meal times, they're another trigger. And if you're missing lots of meals or you're just grabbing something on the run, your brain is just like, oh gosh, you know, what time of day is it? Is it morning, evening? You know, and if you carry on eating through it, you know, just into the night, it's completely confused. You know, it just thinking, well, I'm not really sure if it's daytime or nighttime, so I'm just going to stay awake anyway. So, you know, it's giving our bodies really, it loves routine, it loves structure, it likes sort of stability, really. And so it's using those sort of natural triggers to really embed embed good sort of sleep practices. Yeah.
Yeah. So really it's about reinforcing that circadian rhythm, the sleep wake cycle, and giving all the cues and signals to your brain that you can, that this is morning, this is middle of the day, this is evening, and now we wind down and we get ready for bed, and trying to sort of have a regularish time that you stick to for when you sleep and wake up to sort of keep that body clock in sync.
Absolutely. With yourself. And after a while, the body starts to expect sleep. If you anchor the morning, a morning wake up time, and you know, it can be, it's a bit boring maybe for, you know, to wake up at the same time at the weekend, because lying and the stuff that, you know, that the devil hates for sleep. You know, so it can be a bit of a boring sort of message. But if you're trying to get your sleep on track, you know, you can play around with it later. And I think this is the important thing. If your sleep is off the rails, just hang on in there, get up at the same time every day, anchor your sleep, sort of your body clock, so that you've got that same time to blow that balloon up. So, you know, if you keep blowing it up at different rates, it's going to get tired, it's going to get full at different times, you know, and that's where the whole thing starts to really go off the rails. So and as I say, you can be this, and this is the lovely thing that I do in the sleep retreats, in a sense, is that, you know, if you understand all of this sort of sleep science stuff, you can, it's a sustainable long-term way of managing your own sleep. You know, it's not sort of do this, do that. If people understand why, then they're much more likely to take it on, aren't they? You know, they're much more likely to sort of take on those sort of skills. So it's a real passion of mine, as you can probably know.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that whole understanding the reason why you do things, or why it can be beneficial to do things. It's definitely helpful, I think, in continuing after the initial motivation of trying something or changing something, is understanding why you're doing that and how it might be helpful.
Absolutely.
And when we talked about the sleep drive, will that also be helpful in terms of some people wake up early, don't they? And they don't feel like they've had enough sleep, but then they can't fall back asleep. So again, it's coming back to that sleep drive and everything we do during the day that will have an impact on that too.
Yeah. There is also, I think, you know, it's important to mention too that, you know, there are sleep disorders like obstructive sleep apnea that are extremely common and very, very undiagnosed. And that will basically give you symptoms of excessive snoring, daytime tiredness, fragmented sort of sleep, but you may not, some people don't, not even aware that they're waking up, but they might get up to go to the loo quite a bit, wake with a dry mouth, wake with a headache, just feel really lacking in energy, but that, you know, it's excessive snoring. And that occurs when they're lying back and the neck muscles are actually occluding their airway. And so the oxygen levels start to dip. And that can sometimes, if in severe sleep apnea, it can actually stop breathing sort of 30 times a night, an hour rather, you know, so very, very frequent. And if your brain has been starved of oxygen repeatedly overnight, you're not going to wake up feeling very refreshed. No. So, you know, that is something that, you know, if you have those symptoms, it's definitely worth seeking medical advice and it can be treated. So, you know, it is definitely worth looking into. But early morning wakening, that can be lack of sleep drive again. But the other reason why we wake early in the morning is because about 3-4 o'clock, our cortisol, our stress level, our stress hormone, that starts to ramp up. It starts to sort of be secreted to get the body ready for the day. And at the same time, the REM sleep, which is our dream sleep, you get more REM sleep throughout the night, sort of early hours of the morning, and that you sort of wake more frequently. So that becomes, it's quite fragmented sort of sleep. So you get this sort of double whammy, really, you know, when you've got increase in cortisol, more fragmented sleep. And then if you're a little bit sort of anxious, you think, oh my goodness, here we go, I'm going to wake up, gosh, yep, I've just woken up, this is awful, and then your adrenaline whooshes in and that's the end of your night. So there's lots and lots of reasons why that might happen, but again, it's definitely worth treating.
So we've talked about sleep and how it changes through life and sleep needs and the changes in melatonin secretion. What about in the perimenopause? I've had a lot of women contact me about, I mean, there's so many things change for women in that time, but sleep seems to be a really problem for women around this.
And it certainly is.
Is this something that you deal with as well? And can we go through perhaps some reasons for that and things that these women can do?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's if you understand the reasons why this happens, it helps you it helps to sort of make sense of it, really. And you know that there are five or six main reasons why this should happen with estrogen. I mean, in the perimenopause, the levels of estrogen and progesterone are unstable, and so they're beginning to fluctuate. Now, estrogen is very, very fundamental in sleep quality. So if you may have slept absolutely up until now, but obviously estrogen level starts to dip, then your sleep quality is going to suffer. I think one key thing to say right at the very, very beginning of this is that all of these changes are temporary. You know, you may find your sleep has a disturbed period of time, but this isn't going to last forever. And I think, you know, a lot of people go into the menopause and think, right, that's it, that's me finished, I'm never ever going to sleep again, you know, this is going to be like this for the rest of my life. And then the other reasons for insomnia sort of enter in, and that's when you get this chronic long-term insomnia. And that's what I see a lot, is right. People that have navigated their way through the menopause, come out the other side and still not sleeping, but there are different reasons now why they're not sleeping.
But that's kind of like mindset, isn't it?
It really is. Also, it's good to be aware that estrogen affects the production of melatonin, and melatonin is your sleep hormone. And so if your estrogen level starts to drop, so your melatonin starts to drop. Now, this is also a double whammy, because if we rewind our conversation earlier on, we were talking about how melatonin secretion changes anyway. And so we've got this natural drop in melatonin release, plus you've got your good old estrogen saying, no, I'm not going to sort of release any more melatonin. So between those two things, you know, that's where you start to run into bubbling. The other thing that estrogen does is it transfers magnesium. It transfers the magnesium into the tissues. And magnesium is crucial for sleep. So, you know, this is much more your domain than mine, I'm sure. But, you know, thinking about, you know, how you can boost your magnesium in your diet, how you can, you know, you can have your nuts, you can have, you know, this whole list of lovely foods that you can eat more of, or whether you take a magnesium supplement to try and actually get that magnesium back into your tissues. So, you know, that is another reason why it causes problems. Temperature changes. This is a biggie, isn't it? You know, goodness me. I mean, this is an interesting one, actually, that estrogen, with the hot flashes and things, it's actually the skin temperature that's changing and not the core body temperature. And, you know, having been there, done that, it is quite hard to actually believe that you are not completely on fire at that point, you know. So it is actually quite hard to sort of understand that your core body temperature is not raising that much, but your skin body temperature is.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that wakes you up. Then what happens on top of that is you just start to get agitated. You start to thrash around. You know, you're ripping clothes off. You're ripping, you know, getting the fan out. You're burning more energy yourself because of all of your excessive muscle movement. Your body is expecting you to have a reduced muscle energy use. Instead, it's got an increased muscle energy use. And so that's what wakes you up. So, you know, it's a very, very sort of multi sort of faceted sort of problem. Throw in a bit of mindset, throw in a bit of anxiety, throw in a, oh my goodness, I'm awake. How am I going to cope with tomorrow's day? I'm going to lose my job. This is awful. Da, 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 da. You know, throw in all of that. And there you have everything ripe for lack of sleep. So it's trying to, again, it's sort of trying to have a sort of more measured approach. And, you know, this is really hard to do. And I've been there and I still am in a certain extent. You know, menopause is a wicked, wicked thing. But, you know, it's whether you start using HRT, because the HRT will obviously balance out your, you know, increase your estrogen. And, you know, but when you are sort of having this sort of time, it's thinking, okay, I'm not going to get stressed out. I'm be very mindful. I'm going to be try and be calm. I'm not going to have this massive muscle activity, you know, and throwing things about and rushing around the house trying to get cool. I'm just going to lie here and I'm going to just know that this will pass. This is going to pass. This is not going to be like this forever. And actually just trying to readjust your mindset and calming the whole process down. One thing that is absolutely crucial here is breathing, because if you use resonant breathing and, you know, calming your breathing down, you can actually switch off that, you know, that whole process of fight and flight that you've just triggered, you know, or your body has just triggered, not you have, but, you know, your body. So, you know, you can override that completely, which is a really, really useful key to really learn, is just thinking, okay, I'm just going to lie here. Yeah, I feel really hot. Yeah, I feel dreadful. I'm going to just focus on my breathing and just get into this resonant breathing and, you know, and know that this period will change.
Yeah, that's really helpful, thank you, because as I say, I think it's such a big issue that a lot of women aren't sure how to deal with, and absolutely, you've gone through some really good tips there. So obviously it's very individual in terms of HRT, and women should go and see their GP to talk about that. But then, as you said, the other things they can do, sort of increase the magnesium in their diet. So the other thing I was going to say as you were talking is, this is a really important time, I think, for women to really focus on other areas of lifestyle as well, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So look at their diet, look at their sort of movement and exercise levels, look at their stress levels overall, because that's going to impact it more. And you've mentioned breath work, which is brilliant. And that can be a really good way, as you say, to just calm things down and help you to potentially fall back to sleep in the night, but also maybe do a bit during the day as well. Again, just to bring those stress levels down, bring the cortisol down a bit, and all helps with that sleep drive again, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, you know, it is such a holistic sort of picture, isn't it? I mean, we haven't even had time to sort of touch on the gut microbiome in a sense with that, you know, and that's just a massive thing. And that, again, if you're looking to sort of actually do something active to you know, to promote your sleep and to promote your health, looking into your sort of what you're eating and your gut microbiome is absolutely essential. I mean, you know, 80% of serotonin is made in your gut. And so, you know, serotonin is needed for melatonin and the sleep hormone. So, you know, all of these things are, it's just so, so huge and holistic, isn't it? But you can be proactive. And I think that's really empowering to think, yep, okay, I'm in this situation, but I can, there is a lot that I can do to help myself. You know, it's a lot I can do to keep well. Yes. So, yeah, it's so important, you know? So, yeah.
That's lovely. Jo, we've run out of time, but I mean, I could have spoken for another few hours on any and all of this. And there's so much we haven't covered, actually.
Isn't there, Jess?
Yeah. A sleep part two.
Yeah, maybe. That'll be good. That'll be fun.
If people would like to connect with you, if they're looking for extra help or just information or find out what you're up to, where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm on all the sort of social media platforms. Instagram, Facebook, all of that. My one-to-one work is under Why Sleep, so W-Y-E, Sleep. And then I also run a sleep retreat. And so the sleep retreat are weekends away for sort of condensed support and, sleep sort of nourishment, really, sleep training, as it were. So I'll be launching more of those. We should have had two already, but good old COVID sort of paid to that one. So, we'll get them back on track. So whysleep@gmail.com is my email address, and you can find me there. But yeah.
Brilliant. And I'll put links to all of that in when I
lovely
as well. Yeah. Thank you, Jo. It's been absolutely lovely speaking to you today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been lovely to talk to you, Mona. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today, and I really hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Do follow me on Instagram @thehealthspandoctor for information on the show, as well as recipes and health and nutrition advice. Until next week, let's live life better.